This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
We're here at Menards Bank Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint. Batteries.
Tools. Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste. Cereal. Coffee. Dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at
I know. Don't worry. You're wow. My sidekick is bossy today. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. I'm Dr. G. I have my trusted RVT and sidekick in this adventure, Mallory, with me.
Hello.
Another surprise guest.
Yes. I really enjoy these because I hope you realize how many people you've mentored and stayed with and connected with over your years of practicing and how important mentorship really is. So I love bringing back these people that you've mentored. I love seeing them grow up. I love seeing them grow in their careers. I love to see how much they've changed. And I like to let you give them a hard time a little bit just to bring back the
I'll give
times.
Anybody a hard time. I love giving people a hard time.
You have no problem with that.
I have no problem with giving people a hard time.
So we're gonna do a guessing game today. You get five yes or no questions, and I'm going to leave them up to you.
Five yes or no?
Yes.
That wasn't one
that's,
of them.
That's one of your numbers. That's not one of them. What's your first one?
Is this person still practicing?
Yes.
Is this person, can I like ask West Coast or East Coast?
I'll give you that. West Coast.
Is this person, ooh, did this person stay on the West Coast for veterinary school?
Yes.
Oh, my. Have I talked to this person recently?
I don't think so. How recent?
I don't
Wait,
know.
These are supposed to be yes or no. No. I'll say no.
Is this person a female or male?
Male.
Oh, that limits it.
It does. It does.
It does limit it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. West Coast. Stayed on the West Coast. I'll ask you one last question. I think I got it.
What?
Did this person show dogs?
They did.
Oh, I know exactly who it is.
Who is it?
Anders.
You got it.
Anders!
All right, put your headphones on.
And by the way,
so
yes,
you.
I did talk to him recently.
Oh, you did? Oh,
yes.
Good. All right. I didn't know.
Anders, what's going on?
Good. How are you doing, G?
Dude, the sun doesn't come out in Washington, does it?
The last couple of weeks, it's been real cold and sunny, but it's going to start raining today. So, yeah, not a lot of sun.
Oh, my gosh. So, everyone, this is Anders. He worked with me. I got to get to know him through Dr. Hamill. You were a big-time show dog person.
Yeah,
you were a crazy. You had all those pictures with all those trophies and everything.
Yeah.
Anders has been very, he has a very interesting story, and I'm going to let him kind of tell it. through the questions I asked. I have to be careful. I still think about how much is said because I still think there's some issues there. But he definitely from day one, you could tell that this was going to be a great professional representation of what veterinary medicine was going to be. You could tell that he was in it for the right reasons. And you could also, you could tell he was in it for the long haul. So Anders went to Washington State University and he stayed in the area. How far are you from Washington State right now?
It's about 6 hours. So it's all the way across the other side of the state.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so I thought you were near Pullman. You're not near Pullman?
No, I'm near Seattle.
Oh, you're near Seattle. Even better. So hence the rain and the moisture and everything else that you get, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So you graduated how long ago?
2014, so coming up on 11 years.
11 years out. And 11 years right when you graduated. 11 years. Mallory just looked at me and she said, that makes me feel so old.
Yeah. I think I met you and Mallory in 18 years ago.
Oh my gosh. 18 years ago. That is unbelievable. Wow. Time has flown. 18 years. So you graduated Washington State and you were one of the ones I could say that could probably handle going right into general practice with how much you had learned prior to going to veterinary practice. I think your education, do you believe, before veterinary school helped prepare you for veterinary school?
Absolutely. I mean, I had over 5,000 hours in clinic prior to vet school.
Wow.
Which is a lot. I mean, I worked during the summer, I worked 70-hour weeks. I just couldn't get enough of it. And yeah. I'm not the smartest person. I had to work really hard to get good grades. The first 2 years of vet school where you learn all the normal and some of the pathology, they were the hardest. Third year of vet school, I mean, I knew the answers to what the diseases were. I didn't necessarily know the pathophysiology till they were explained in class. But, you know, teacher would ask, the professor would ask, what's the diagnosis? I raise my hand, I get it right every time. People look, how do you know? I said, well, I've seen 6 cases of it already. I can tell you how to treat it too.
I've been through many C-sections. I've been through many, many different things you wouldn't even believe. So you were one of those vet students that were able to intubate the dog immediately?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, I remember during C-section, they had me scrub out of surgery and revive the puppies because their technicians didn't know how to do it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't ask you to stay there. I really am, because you were so prepared for what you were doing and what you were, going in. You reminded me of me.
Well, I appreciate that. I had a few professors who were clinicians who said, are you sure you don't want to do an internship and residency? I said, yeah, I want to do general practice. And they said, why would you waste your talents on general practice, is what they told me. And I looked at them and I said, you need good vets like me to send you cases.
Exactly. Good comeback, because I would have lost my shit on them, because that's the problem I have, is I really feel as if veterinary schools no longer are... They need general practice. We need general practitioners. Don't get me wrong. There is a huge need for surgeons.
Absolutely.
Now I'm all crying and I'm all coughed up here. But, oh my goodness. Yes. Thank you. We'll edit that out. No, there's a huge need for surgeons. There's a huge need for internists. There's a huge need for oncologists, ophthalmologists. But that's not the job for everyone.
Right.
And uh, I, I, I gathered that you love general practice just because you saw how great it could be.
Yeah, oh, I love it. And I mean, every day it's fun to come to work. I mean, I couldn't imagine not doing it. You know, I saw that when I was working with you guys, how much you guys enjoyed it and how fun that was. It was kind of funny growing up. I thought that in order to be a veterinarian, you had to own your practice. I just thought that was, you know, obviously, you know, as I was in high school, all that, I learned, yeah, you know, that's not necessarily the case, but that's what the world it was when I was a kid. It was GPs owned, not corporate owned.
Yeah. Well, the corporate piece in the last 8 years or so has really changed the landscape of the practice setting. But there's absolutely, I'm very happy to say there is a renaissance movement where people are starting to start buy their own practices again and create their own legacies and create their own babies. And it's a very rewarding thing. So you graduated, because I want to go through your story step by step. You graduated veterinary school and you found a job.
Yeah. Yep.
And this job was a solo practitioner.
Solo practitioner back in my hometown, someone I knew growing up.
Did you take your animals to him when you were growing up?
Yeah. Yep, I did.
Okay, awesome. So
he was 65 years old. My plan was always to own. That was like, it wasn't even a question. It was just, and you know, there's a few vets in the area that I knew, but he was at the closest age to retirement and indicated that was his goal.
And you also had that trust, right? Because he was your veterinarian growing up. He took care of your animals growing up. You knew the practice growing up. You probably asked him questions about becoming a veterinarian growing up. Did you ever work there at all growing up?
I did work there a little bit, like here and there, but it was more just shadowing and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay, so you start working there. And what was the handshake agreement you guys had before going in?
Yeah, the handshake agreement was, you know, he wants to sell the practice to me. And he thought he had a year or two left at that point. That was in 2014. And, you know, that was the plan. And, you know, he was apprehensive or just a little nervous about bringing somebody on because he didn't know if we'd have enough business. But, you know, he was working some pretty light hours as well, at that point. So,
yeah, well, he's 65, right? I mean, the beautiful thing about the profession is you can work till you're 80. I had Dr. Kacheri on for episode. He's turning 80 this year and he's still doing TPLOs, FHOs and all those fun things. 'Cause he loves it so much. But for him, you thought for sure, okay, this is going to be a great deal for me. I'm going to be able to go in there. I can build my clientele. I can get the practice going, and then I'm going to be in charge.
Right.
Okay, so did you get any of this in writing?
I did not.
You did not. So, you know, take-home message is, number one, handshake deals are awesome back in the Wild Wild West, but handshake deals don't really exist nowadays. Because even if someone says they give you their word, if it's not in writing, it's just worth as much as their word, which is usually not much, especially when it comes to money. Because money can divide families, money can divide friendships, and definitely money can dictate people to do, you know, things that are kind of shady, we'll put it that way, to keep it PG. Now, when you decided, okay, how long were you there before the conversation of you buying in started up again?
Yeah, so after a year, I just casually checked in, and he thought, you know, and his response was, maybe a year or two. Same response as at the beginning, right? So then really 2 years in is when I said, hey, what's your plan? And then again, he said a year or two. So after 4 years, I said, hey, you know what? I want to meet with you, coffee outside of the practice. And I just want to just meet with you. And so I met with him and I just said, hey, look, I just need to know your plan. I want to know what your future looks like, what that looks like, because you know, I'm ready to be owner, and you know, that's kind of what we had talked about, and where are you at? And oh, go ahead.
How was his response to that?
Yeah. So his response to that was, I'll tell you when I'm ready. And I looked at him, and I said, no, you've been telling me that for 4 years. I need to know. Like, if you need a few weeks to think about it, that's fine. But I just, like, I'm trying to plan my future. And I need to know where you're at. You know, I like working with you. I think what you've built is great, but that's where I'm at.
Yeah, you know, that I had the same type of story. When I came out of vet school, I mean, I didn't think I'd be coming out to California. I thought I'd be in the Keys, living the Jimmy Buffett lifestyle. I had a possible job lined up in the Keys, and I was all excited. But then, of course, I met my wife at the interview, and she always wanted to come back to California to work with her dad. So I found a job while I was doing an externship. And he was really excited to get me on. And he, you know, but the thing is, I knew my worth, and I was not going to be a statistic as far as, you know, we barely are getting paid, our student loans are so bad. I'm like, I'm coming out to California. The cost of living is about 3x everywhere else. I really need to be paid correctly. So he made a deal with me. He's like, you increase my gross revenue by $500,000, I'll give you 20% of that. So I'm looking at about $100,000 bonus. Well, eight months in, he realized that we are going to probably blow by that number, and he's been spending all the money that I was bringing in. And he started to cut his hours. He would only work 2 hours a day instead of his eight. So our income started to drop. And I totally caught on to it too, because I'm like, because I could watch. I mean, that's the cool things with these programs now, like with Avamark, Impromed, Cornerstone, you name it. You can really follow the revenue, what you're generating, stuff like that. And I caught on to him quickly, and I called him out on it. And he's like, oh well, you know, I thought you wanted more freedom. And I'm like, man, I've been out for 8 months. I don't need freedom. I need someone standing here. I need someone helping me. I need someone dealing with all the staff that was upset. And so that, yeah. And even though I had it in writing, he still screwed me over a different way.
Well, that's the thing. You can get it in writing and it doesn't hold up. So,
but at least I had something to go fall back on when I walked out of there. And he ended up giving me a little extra cash when I left, just because he was worried about legal ramifications. But it's just because I had it in writing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you had your coffee, and he said, I'll let you know when I let you know. And you're 2 years in.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then we set up another meeting for 2 weeks. And so I show up to this meeting without him telling me. He brings his accountant to the meeting, and he uses his accountant kind of as an attorney as well, even though he's not. And he says, you know, maybe in a year or two. And I look at him, I say, well, that's not good enough. And then he hands me a contract with a non-compete in it, because I didn't have a contract going in.
So don't non-competes, they don't fly in California. Do they fly in Washington?
At that point they potentially did. But I didn't have one. I didn't. And so he hands it to me. I said, I'll get back to you. So I just ignored it. And so, you know, a month goes by, and I mean, granted, so I increased his revenue by 3 times.
Correct.
And he didn't change his hours. So he was doing well. He most money he's ever made in his life. He didn't even know you could do this in veterinary medicine, you know, where you could actually do good work, charge appropriately, treat the patients well, and win, and everybody wins, right?
Correct.
And he paid me for it. He, you know, I was doing well, because we did a based on the gross, or you know, on the on my percentage of like 20%, just like you. And And so he asked me, you know, just casually sitting there, so are you going to sign it? And I said, I'm not. And he said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to keep my options open. And, you know, then nothing happened with him for a while. He didn't come back because he knew he was stuck.
Correct.
Right. You know, and so then I went on this exploration of what would it look like? You know, I liked this practice. I wanted to stay there. But what would it look like if I bought another existing practice? And so I looked at that. There was a guy up the road who had a practice, and he was ready to get out. He was younger. Turns out they had the same accountant. And so we got into it a little bit, and then that accountant shows up for me to do an exam on his cat at the clinic, scheduled an appointment with me, didn't pay for it. And the whole appointment of his quote-unquote sick cat was, you don't want to buy that other practice. It's got all these problems.
Wow.
Right, which is, I mean, he really breached his clients, both clients' trust in that. So then things got a little bit weird for a while. So then I said, well, what are my other options? I said, well, I could do a startup.
At any point were you thinking this guy is dragging his feet because he's trying to raise the sale price on me by the business that I'm creating?
Absolutely, right? And that's what I was worried about. That's why I said, you know, if you don't know when you're going to retire, let's set a price now.
Okay, good.
And he didn't want to do that.
Of course, you know, not.
Of course. Yeah. So I looked in, and, you know, I'll tell you what, I met a family friend who is a contractor, and their specialty is actually building out veterinary clinics. So I met with her and I said, what would this look like? You know, just is it even possible? I didn't know at that time. Turns out that they had an opening in one of the buildings that they owned. Tenant was leaving, and they've known my family forever. My mom watched her kids in daycare, and they wanted to they wanted me in there. So this happened real quick. They got the build out done in 55 days.
55. How many square feet did they build out in 55 days?
2,800.
2,800 square feet. Okay.
And so they got it done, and it just went boom. They said they, you know, they had people that were available to, like, the banker. They had here, talk to this guy, you know, all these veterinary specific things, because that's what they did. And it went quick, and it just happened. I mean, it was one of those things where I was just looking at what are the options, and then it became, I actually could do this.
Okay, so during those 55 days, you're still working for your original doctor. And,
correct.
And you were keeping your mouth shut that this is happening, correct?
Right.
Was there how did you deal with that emotionally, like mentally, physically? I could imagine it was so draining because you're like, hey, I'm leaving this place.
Right. You know, so I did a couple things because I really wanted to be ethical. I wanted to, so I didn't say anything to any clients, not at all, because to me, that's not fair to his business, even though I felt like I earned those clients, right? I did not say a word. It was my wife and I and my parents and her parents, really. Those are the only people that knew about this the whole time.
And the people building it out.
And the people building it out, which some of them were clients, so that was a little awkward, but... they are also people I'd known my whole life because I grew up here. My dad taught first grade for 40 years at the same school here. In fact, the theater at that elementary school is named Forson Theater after him because he did a lot of musical stuff. So I'm really entrenched in the community. And I would say it was hard because I was excited.
Correct.
I mean, this is something I've been looking forward to my entire life. And, you know, I look back now because I met with the contractor on December 3rd of 2018. My daughter was born December 6th of 2018, and she was 3 months early.
I remember that. Okay.
So we were in the NICU. every day. So I would wake up 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd drive to the NICU, which wasn't too far away, go spend some time with my daughter. Then I'd stop by the job site to see how the build is coming along. Then I'd go to work. Then I'd stop by the job site again on the way home. Then I'd go back to the NICU, and I'd get home about 10, 11 o'clock at night. All the time doing all the different paperwork and pro formas and all that stuff for what it would look like to do a startup. You know, I remember in school they said, don't do startups. That's a bad idea. No one can make it doing a startup. So I came out of school being like, okay, I got to buy someone's practice. But I realized, no, you don't have to do that. If people are not giving you the opportunity, they promised.
So these are the same people who also told you don't go into small general practice, right? You need to specialize.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly.
And in school, they gave you absolutely no business direction either, correct?
No, they had a business club, business class. But, I mean, it's more, investing, things like that, which are, valuable tools. But
nothing on how to read a P&L, nothing on how to look at profit, your gross revenue sales, what percentages your payroll should be, your rent should be, your inventory should be, the important things. Let's talk about, let's talk about 401k.
Right. Exactly. And I will say, I think one of the big problems, because, our industry definitely has some issues with mental health that we're seeing. And I think one of the biggest contributors, because imagine going through all this and then you have $300,000 of student loans to pay as well. And then your car breaks and then your refrigerator shuts down and your whatever, the mental stress that could be would be incredible.
Oh, I could just imagine. And a baby in the NICU.
Right? And that's where I think in our profession we get to our breaking point, right? Luckily, I paid my loans off in a year and a half.
Because you were grinding and hustling.
Because I was grinding and hustling. And you know what they tell you? They tell you don't do that. They say invest in the market because you can get 10%. Your loans are 3%. And while that maths out, what the math equation doesn't equate for is peace and stress-free, because you get out of school, they say, well, you should buy a car, you should buy a house, you should buy all these things. I drove my 2000 Pontiac Grand Am for 5 years. that thing that I drove when I worked for you, that thing, the windows didn't work, yes. The air conditioning didn't work. In fact, the windows would fall down and I had to use a shim to keep them up. I'm out there making, a good amount, six figures, and I'm driving this piece of crap car, and why? Because I knew if I got out of my student loan debt, I could do all those things and buy a new car.
Yeah. But you got to remember too, though, I had a financial guy on one of the episodes, and there's good debt and there's bad debt. So,
sure.
I just want everyone listening to understand that if your 2000 Pontiac Grand Am has windows that doesn't work and your air conditioning doesn't work, it's not bad debt to go buy yourself a small SUV or, something, or a minivan if you're starting a family or something like that. It is bad debt if you go buy the Porsche. or the Corvette. I mean, if it's something that makes sense, like a pickup truck or something like that, that's still good debt because you're still going to use it. You still need it. I would love to know how you were moving stuff into a new build with a Pontiac Grand Am.
I shoved all my stuff in there. I just got it done. I borrow trucks. I'm also the guy that in vet school over in Pullman, I wouldn't turn on the heat till I could see my breath inside. I was living cheap. I had, my budget for groceries was $100 a month, and that's why I only had $150,000 in student loans instead of, $200,000-$300,000 that people are having now.
Yeah, $100 a month. Wow. That was 7 years ago, 8 years ago? No, more than that.
2010 to 2014. Yeah. So, you get a box of spaghetti. So, a pound of spaghetti And when I was first starting vet school, I'd eat a whole pound in one meal. And then I said, you know what? I could starve myself and eat half a pound. And that's double the meals. So I do stupid stuff like that.
Dude, cup of noodles. You could get 10 cup of noodles for a dollar. You know, you're better off doing it that way.
Then I come out of school and I work, you know, as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
And not only what does a couple things, right? I see a ton of cases.
Correct.
I get to do a lot. And, you know, I was doing PUs on cats. I was, you know, doing like, hey, I want to learn how to do this. Let me do this. And doing everything I possibly could. And it was good for me learning wise. I enjoyed it. But it also was able to help speed up my debt payoff.
Well, even though this guy was probably not the cleanest of all business people, he was still a good mentor to you.
Yeah, I mean, he was a good veterinarian, a good surgeon, you know, and I really respect him. I still do. It's tough to say that just because he's put me through some things that are tough. But I'm better for it, for sure.
Oh, we're not done with your story yet, so don't think you're getting out of it, because it gets juicy. We're kind of getting to the climax right here. So 55 days pass.
Yeah.
How many days did you give him before you were leaving?
So the day before I was putting in my notice, sitting in the office in the morning, he said, when are you going to tell me? When were you going to tell me?
So the word got out.
Somebody, somehow, don't know how. I have suspicions, but I don't know how. And I looked at him and I said, tell you what? And
plausible deniability, right?
Yeah, right. And so I said, well, you know, I was going to tell you tomorrow. I had a letter already signed and written in my car, a resignation letter, just, you know, thanking him for all the, you know, the years and for employing me and all that stuff. And so then that was an awkward Friday.
I bet it was.
Because that was in the morning and I didn't talk to him. He didn't say a word to me, and we were fairly close. I mean, sharing cases back and forth and all that stuff. So I didn't hear much the rest of that day.
And was it a 2-week notice? Was it a 30-day notice, or was like, out of here?
So I was going to give him 2 weeks because I suspected it wasn't going to go well.
Yeah. That's a good suspicion. I mean, very good suspicion.
Yeah. So for me, like I would have loved to give him notice.
Right.
But I just knew it wasn't going to be good. And, you know, same time, I had a child in the NICU. Her first day she was born, over $1 million was the bill for one day.
That's incredible.
I mean, luckily we have insurance, right? But over $1 million. And I mean, not once did I ever think that I was going to fail at the startup. I should have. I should have been like, hey, what if this doesn't work? But I nowhere did that wasn't even on my radar.
But you can, you had that, you're an entrepreneur. You had those thoughts. It's not like you didn't think in the back of your head, holy cow, what did I, you know, what, you know, I'm pregnant with this. I can't get unpregnant. You know, I am so deep into this. You honestly never had in your mind, hey, this is going to work?
Not that I recall ever thinking. There was, in my mind, no chance that I wouldn't be successful.
Okay. Wow. So, I mean, you got to remember, Anders, being an entrepreneur is, in general, is a risk taker. So, you're okay with the risk.
Apparently, and maybe I was sleep deprived with the baby and all that stuff.
Correct.
But I mean, it wasn't even a question of would I succeed. It was how long would it take for me to basically need to hire somebody else.
Now that's the attitude I'd love to hear. Okay, so let's for the listeners, tell me geographically how many miles apart are the two practices.
They're 2 miles apart.
2 miles apart. So this is small town, 2 miles
apart. One end of town to the other. Completely opposite end of town.
Oh, wow. Okay, so two ends of town, and here you are. So how long did you last? Did you last those 2 weeks?
No. I showed up the next morning, and he said, you have 5 minutes to get your shit and get the out of here.
You have 5 minutes to get your shit and get the F out of here. Okay, awesome. So that's a Saturday.
Yeah.
You open doors on Monday?
I would have. the build wasn't quite ready.
Okay.
So I had 2 weeks. Turns out I needed those 2 weeks to get all the stuff put together, get everything finalized. But that's when stuff got real.
Yeah. Well, during those 2 weeks, did you use that to hire staff or, you know, put an ad out in the paper and all that fun stuff?
Yep. So I kind of had some people kind of lined up already. I started with only 3 staff members total.
A receptionist, a technician, and yourself.
No technician. An assistant.
An assistant. Okay, so an assistant, a receptionist, yourself, and that's all you got hired, and you're like, okay, let's go.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. You know, and I hope all the listeners are listening to this, because this story is proof that resiliency is a must in our profession. You're not going to always go into a practice that has the RVT. It's not going to have the 4 receptionists. It's not going to have the other doctor. It's not going to have the kennel staff. It's not going to have all the things. So, and especially if you're the entrepreneur, guess what? You're all those. You're the manager, you're the entrepreneur, and the doctor, and the kennel boy, and the receptionist. So how many times did you answer the phone the first couple months you were open personally to make appointments?
You know, not many.
Oh, good.
Not many. You know, it's one of those where I was doing blood draws.
Okay.
All the fecal, you know, I was reading fecal, I was doing all the things. Which, you know, I guess, you know, I look back at the practice I started at. They didn't have a LVT when I started there. They did end up getting one. But what that made me do is learn how to do all that stuff and get really good at it. I mean, I could do it already because of the hours that I put in before vet school. But to me, the doctor needs to be the person that if the technician can't get it, you have to. There's no option.
Correct. You're
And maybe, you know, I don't draw blood very often anymore. But if they can't, I have to do it.
The buck stops with you, dude. The buck stops with you.
Yeah, yeah. So to me, I did develop those skills, and so I said, you know what? I can do that still in this startup. You know, I'm not going to go out and spend, you know, all the money that I don't have on staff, and, you know, and we grew quick. We grew quick.
Okay, so... So Dr. Slim Shady, when does he get involved again?
Yeah. So 3 weeks into me being open, I get a demand letter for $1.8
million. $1.8
million.
So at least you know what he was going to sell the practice to you for.
Yeah, right. $1.8 million. Had a guy show up in my lobby with a gun to serve me these papers.
And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, I got to find an attorney.
Yeah. Freaking out. Yeah. Freaking out.
Wow. Did you have any family connections for an attorney?
I didn't. One of my employees, her dad was an entrepreneur as well. So I gave him a call and I said, hey, do you have anybody?
So you started to use network, which is very, very smart.
Yep.
You got to use a network.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, business attorney, right? Just and you know, I'll tell you what, I did have a family connection who was a judge in the county, and so I called her as well. And that she was very kind to help me.
Right. Well, you didn't sign the non-compete, so I don't know what he had against you.
Well, we don't know either. So I will tell you, though, that first attorney that I went to, he kind of used some attorney tricks that, you know, he said, oh, this is a little, you know, you could be in some trouble here. You know, all these, you know, words that made me think he's not really for me.
Correct.
So I switched attorneys.
Good job.
Well, I didn't switch attorneys until they actually filed the lawsuit a few months later. Because he had been talking to this other attorney, and then all of a sudden we get hit with no negotiation, just a lawsuit.
Awesome. So what year is this?
Same year, but a couple months later.
Okay. So now let's shoot to right now. Is this lawsuit still going on?
It is.
Still going on. Still lingering over your head. Is he still in practice?
You know, I just found out that he was fired by the corporation that bought his practice at the end of 2024.
Wow, me and him have a lot in common.
Yeah,
we have a lot in common then, because my corporate, they didn't fire me. They very nicely asked me to leave.
And yeah, I think they probably would have tried that. I think he just said no.
Wow, so he got fired. So now he can file for unemployment.
Yeah, potentially. I don't know how that works. I mean, they paid him $6.5 million for that practice.
So if you...
It wasn't worth that.
Well, no. Well, I mean, the thing is that these corporate groups are hitting everyone with huge multipliers. So, yeah. I mean, he probably got probably about 8X, 9X what it was truly worth. But it is what it is. So your lawsuit's still going on. Is it getting any traction at all?
No, we haven't heard from them in a long time. And, you know, it's not affecting me at all.
Right.
Here's the thing that I know is if you have something, you go after somebody. I know they don't have anything because I didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
I will say I feel bad that he feels that way, that he feels that I screwed him over. But I know I didn't. I can sleep at night feeling good about the way that I handled myself, and that's all I can control.
Right, but I'm from an outside perspective, I think screw him. You had a kid in the NICU. You were, you know, you're giving this kid, you're dragging him along. You were going to do a totally shady business deal by having him build up the practice and saying that was the practice for, you know, what it's worth after all your blood, sweat, and tears you put into it. And this is a very common story amongst veterinarians that are trying to buy a practice. It's very important you set the price well before you start really, truly getting into it. Like you say, there about 6 months, and then you go, okay, let's set a price. Because if not, my recommendation is you just sit back and relax and just let the practice slowly cook like a slow cooker. And then once hump a stump and you're trying to get there as fast as you can, they're going to use that against you in the sale price.
Yeah. And honestly, I think hindsight, I think his plan was to sell to corporate all along, and he was using my numbers to do that. Now, thankfully, when we subpoenaed the corporate entity, they said that me leaving the practice had nothing to do with the sale price, did not affect it at all. So that helps me quite a bit, I think, in the legal realm there.
Yeah, but you were gone for 3 years by then, 4 years, right?
Well, no. We found out that he was not telling the truth, that he sold it in 2021. He sold the practice.
Okay.
But he kept saying in all the interrogatories that he was still owner.
Right.
So I told my attorney, I said, I thought perjury was a crime. Apparently it's not.
Wow. Well, you know, was he saying that under oath?
Interrogatories are factual. You sign your name under oath. Oh. But it's not a crime, apparently.
It was funny because I don't get into politics, but I thought it was a MAGA hat, but it was actually a hat that said, make crime illegal again. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, right.
So basically, now let's get to the rainbow side.
Yeah.
How's your practice doing?
It's fantastic.
Perfect.
I mean, honestly, it's the best thing that could have happened to me is him saying no.
Yeah. You know, sometimes no is a good thing. It really is.
Yeah.
Have you hired any associates?
Not yet.
Are you looking?
Not yet. I am looking.
And how's that job search coming?
You know, I've had a few people that we've looked at. And for whatever reason didn't work out. They wanted to go to a different area of the country or whatever. You know, I have a good team. I've got 3 LVTs now. I've got, 2 receptionists and all the time, so a rotating schedule. When I first started, though, I was working 6 days a week.
Yeah.
I'd get home, 7 o'clock at night, eat dinner, put my kids to bed, and do charts till 11.
Ugh.
And I did that for 2 full years. And then I said, okay, I'm going to take a half day on Thursdays. And my wife was ecstatic. She thought that was fantastic. So I took a half day, which means that I got home about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. Let's clarify. Half day is not 12. This isn't a banker's half day. It's a veterinarian half day.
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, so we didn't know this at the time, but I opened in July of 2019. So what came in March of 2020
was the greatest thing ever for you.
Was the greatest thing ever, but we didn't know it.
Correct.
At the time. Like, I had no idea what was going to happen. That's when the first set of fear was like, uh-oh.
Are we 2000? See, for me, as soon as that hit, I was like, are we 2008 again, right? And I was ready to pivot because I knew exactly what we did, because I'm very proud to say we didn't get rid of any employees during the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. But I sat them down immediately and I'm like, listen, we're in California. They're probably going to shut us down. I'm going to make sure that you all have full-time jobs and all your bennies. And, and then, of course, Gavin Newsom decided, at first that veterinarians were not first responders. They wouldn't let us stay open. But well, he shortly changed that to like 2 days later, so we were open. We were the busiest practice within 10 miles of us because we did not refuse service to anyone for anything.
Yep. Yeah, and neither did I. And things were starting to get busy for me, but they blew up. They blew up.
Looking back, how many of those clients did you keep? A great percentage?
I think so. We knew the ones that were just calling around, calling 30 clinics and getting into wherever they were. But at that point, I'd take them too because I needed the business. And I think we did retain quite a few because, I'm 4 weeks booked out right now, do drop-offs every day. We only do drop-offs for our clients that have been in before and have a...
You're 4 weeks booked out?
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you do if you have that emergency case? Do you have like little openings in your appointment book just in case?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're 4 weeks booked out for annual exam, general health checks, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I just did a gastrotomy before I jumped on this.
What did we get out of the gastrotomy?
Well, the owner is unsure because they're not missing anything. There's no way that I could have eaten anything. I did get a rubber Kong, part of a rubber Kong toy and a lot of fabric. It's just not discernible as to what it was. My guess is a rope toy. She says she doesn't have rope toys, so I don't know.
Just make sure you don't make it some sort of a woman's garment because she'll probably say, I don't wear that. And the husband will have some questions to wait for him. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, gastronomies are fun. They're easier than a spay.
Absolutely.
I agree with you. It's so easy to do.
And they do well.
They do, as long as you flush the abdomen. But, those are the hard skills. So it sounds like you're ready for an associate now, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then now when you're interviewing these veterinarians that are these new vets, these early career professionals that are coming out, are you noticing a trend or any issues that are concerning to you?
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, the first thing they want to know is how many days they get off.
Wow. Okay. So,
and what's expected of them surgical skills. And I think, I think it's got to be confidence, but I'm not sure. I mean, when I was in vet school, I, on an optional, you know, a rotation where we just had to go to some vet clinic, I went to the Boise Humane Society. I did 100 spays in 2 weeks.
And there's nothing routine about a spay. Let's make that clear.
No, and I think everybody in the area sends me their big dog spays because we do 100-plus pound spays at least 2 or 3 times a week.
Wow. I assure you charge well for those, too, because if you're going to be the only one doing them, you might as well take advantage of it.
I mean, I try and charge appropriately. You know, I want to be fair. I guess that's the way I look at it. Charge for my time, charge, you know. But at the same time, you know, I want people to still be able to afford veterinary medicine.
Correct. Well, the cost of care conversation is completely different. I mean, how is the cost of care skyrocketing up where you're at?
Oh, yeah. TPLO is 10 grand here.
Yeah. So it's about the same. It's about 12, I think, here.
I mean, Seattle, right? So it's, I mean, we have Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and then Farmers. So there's a big divide, right?
Yeah. Wow. Exactly. You get both sides. So
I guess one thing I think is great is that I get clients in here who I grew up going to their farm where I saw my first calf being born, and they are proud to bring their dog in here, and they're not going to do some of those things, but they'll come see me where before they wouldn't even go see a vet. And then I get people that will spend more money than anybody else has, and they'll come in to me too. And I can treat them well and not make them feel judged. I hear at least a few times a week people say, thank you for being honest.
Now, have you had any externs or anyone work through your practice while they were in vet school?
Yeah, I've had a few. We do a lot of canine reproduction. So a lot of them are trying to get experience with that because there's very little in school with that. So we do have a lot that come through looking those skills, or a few, I guess I should say, not a lot.
Progesterones galore. Progesterones galore.
Yeah, but we're doing TCI and all that stuff as well. So.
Oh, wow. Look at transcervical implant. Look at you, yep. TCI. Yep. Look, you're trying to fool the old vet over here. Hey, so so do you ever do surgical implant, or are you always transcervical?
You know, I do fewer than I used to. Mostly doing transcervical now. But every once in a while, someone wants a surgical.
Mm-hmm.
Or for whatever reason, if there's a dog that we feel like has endometrial cysts, we'll do a surgical.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, looking back into your veterinary preparation, is there anything you thought they were missing other than business?
In school?
Yeah.
I think they were missing a lot. It's funny, you look back at med school, what'd you learn? You know, yeah, I think the process, the way you should think about cases, the way to think through things. But there's lots of things that I never heard about in vet school that I knew because of all the hours I put in. And I did that consistently. Like I went and I was there, even though I did full schedule plus in undergrad. I got my undergrad in 3 years. I didn't skimp on my schedule at all, but I still showed up. I was there at least once a week at your clinic, learning everything I could.
Right. Be a sponge, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish you could go back and learn that and then do it, you know, with all I know now, right? I mean, you can glean so much.
Yeah, I think my 5 years of experience before I applied to vet school, I learned more there than I did in vet school. I mean, vet school taught you, like, all the intricacies and the, you know, the pathophysiology of issues, but I think it taught me more about the soft skills, which I argue are lacking a lot in these new career vets. Like, yeah. You know, so if you were going to give the one thing that early career vets need to do now before they graduate senior year, what would you recommend?
I mean, they need to figure out what, if they want to do what they're in school for. In reality, you know, I mentioned earlier, our profession has some burnout issues, right?
Correct.
And I think we have a lot of really bright individuals that go to vet school. These guys are way smarter than I am. They can, you know, pass the test. They can talk to you about how things work more than I can even understand.
Right.
But at the end of the day, they get out and they're like, this is it?
Correct.
I get an empty anal gland. I get, you know, and it's more than just that, but they get out and they're like, wow, I thought it would be different. And I think it's because they don't have enough experience before vet school to know what a vet does, or do you want to be a surgeon or an endocrinologist or whatever? That's great. We need good people to do that. But I don't think they even know that. They just like, hey, I like animals. I'm really smart. You know, I have a buddy I went to vet school at Washington State. They did a class rank system. They didn't give you grades. It was pass fail. And their goal with that was to try and reduce the competition, to not make it about grades, but make it about learning. That was the goal.
I think all graduate programs should be pass fail, by the way.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
Your grades don't matter. Come on.
No, they don't. They don't. So you know, we started with, I believe, 99 kids in our class. We went to, you know, at the end of first semester, you could check your class rank. And they did that for people that wanted to do internships. And so you could, you know, you're ranked whatever in your class. And my buddy, he's a great mixed animal veterinarian in Idaho now. He checked his class rank. By the time we graduated, there were no longer that many people in our class. What he was ranked.
Well, you know,
I never checked mine because I knew it wasn't good.
I dude, the middle of the bell curve's fine, right?
Yeah.
Right. C equals DVM. I mean, that's right. What it comes down to. I mean, because I would sit there and like sit in virology class and I'm like, really? Do we need to know all the ins and outs of a virus? Let's just go over what the virus is, how it attacks, how you take care of it. Like, do I need to know it's an mRNA encapsulated, enveloped, or whatever virus? No.
Somebody does, but not me.
Right. And if those people should go on for their PhD after vet school.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, I think there's some... I don't know if they need to change the classes around a little bit. I think they need to do a lot more basic business stuff. I think they need to do a lot more soft skills stuff. You know, communication, emotional intelligence. I think veterinary schools need to have interviews no matter what. And I really do think veterinary schools need to increase the amount of hours required prior to applying.
Absolutely.
I mean, the fact that there's veterinary schools now that still accept students without any hours at all. Some schools are 100 hours. You won't know anything in 100 hours.
Right. Yeah, I have an employee who just started vet school.
You mentored one into vet school.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Welcome to the club.
So, yeah. So, no, it's pretty exciting, and she's pretty excited. But she applied 3 times. And I tell you what, she's going to be a fantastic veterinarian. She has the soft skills, which you know, I can't find in anybody, hardly, you know, receptionists or anybody. You know, and you know, she did not get into Washington State, which would be in state school. And I said, wow, they are missing out. And I said that in my third letter to them, a letter of recommendation, is if you don't accept this person, you're missing out. Because you can be really smart and diagnose a patient correctly and be a bad veterinarian.
Oh, because you'll piss off every client that comes in to see you.
Yeah, and you may not treat them right, because you didn't actually listen to the client.
Right. You know, I would really love to do a research study, especially now with the younger generation of veterinarians. I would love to have just do a case study where veterinarians have to explain it verbally, and then the same veterinarian can text it via Snap or text or social media what's going on, and see which one is clearer. Because I really think that's kind of the problem. Now, if that's the case, we're not going to be able to change how we communicate, but maybe we make it part, hey, not only am I going to explain this to you, I am going to write this up and snap it to you or text it to you or email it to you. So you have two ways of getting it. I think that would be an interesting study to do. Maybe I'll do that as my postdoc. That'd be fun. Choose one big, busy hospital and have all these interns have to explain it verbally and then via some digital way. And see what they have to say, because I think there's a loss in translation there, you do need to sit there and listen to the client. It's okay to cut the client off at times too, if you need to, but the one thing is to learn how not to let the client dictate or drive the direction of the conversation.
Yeah, no, I had even a case last week. Dog comes in, they say it's not vomiting. I say okay. But it's, it's just not feeling well, not eating. So I ran some blood work on it. Looking at the blood, and the chloride's low. Like, are you sure this dog isn't vomiting? I think this dog is vomiting. Like, no possible way it's vomiting. I said, okay. Well, so it, took x-rays and a little bit of, hazy abdomen, not your great serosal detail. I'm like, I think this dog has a foreign body. They say, no way. I say, okay, well, we need an abdominal ultrasound. So, sure enough, had a foreign body.
And peritonitis.
Yeah, and peritonitis. Well, yeah,
We'll throw that one out. I have a story. My wife, this happened a couple weeks, about 2 months ago. She's like, this dog got into marijuana. I could totally tell it's gotten into marijuana. And she goes up and she's like, is there any chance, your dog could have gotten into cannabis? Oh, no way. We don't have that. No. Back in the day, I understood because people thought we would call the cops. But nowadays, it's legal. No, we don't do that. The devil's lettuce. Don't go near it. So then, so she walks him back and the dog vomits and it just reeks of cannabis. So she goes and gets the owner, and the owner comes back, and she can smell it immediately. And she's like, yeah, I guess it did get into our marijuana stash.
I it's funny because I had a similar marijuana story where I had a puppy. It was a Doberman puppy, and it, marijuana toxicity. So I said, and the guy's like, no way. I said, okay, well, I'm going to treat it that way. I'm going to give it some fluids. Puppy got better. Next time the dog comes in, I just asked him, the guy's like, what do you do for a living? He's like, oh, I run a grow. I was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I run a grow. I have, 400 acres of marijuana plants, but there's no way this dog... you get some crazy stories, but
it's fun though. I mean, God, veterinary medicine is so awesome.
It is, because if you're able to sit down and have these types of conversations and laugh about it, that's what makes veterinary medicine fun. If these same things happen to you and you get so upset and you beat yourself up over it and you sit there and you ruminate and you just go over it, your head and over again, it's going to kill you. So
absolutely,
it will destroy you. It will destroy. I don't care what profession you're in. It will destroy you. What did you? And last question for you. What was your go to, especially with all the crap you're going through with, Dr. Shady, to get back, get back your mind? What would you do for mindfulness or to get it out of your head?
Yeah, I mean. Conversations certainly with my wife. I'm a Christian, so I read the Bible, pray. to really help clear my mind and give me some peace, right? And then, you know, also just remember that, hey, you know what? I did nothing wrong. And I'm doing the best I can every single day to help pets. And I love this profession so much that, I mean, to me, it's not work. I show up and this is just fun. It's like, oh, man, it's been a while since I've seen one of these. Or, you know, I mean, it's just, it's fun. And every case is a little different. You know, you have the clients that tell you too much or the clients that don't tell you anything. You know, you build these relationships. You know, I had a dog that the owners called and said, we think he's painful. I said, well, bring it in. And we took a look at it. By the time we got here, it was dead.
Wow.
And I'm just like, well, I mean, there's obviously more going on than a little bit of pain. And I was in surgery at the time when, you know, I just said, just bring it in. I'll look at it after I finish surgery. And so the owners, they left. And so I called them afterwards and we talked about what we think could have happened, you know, whether it's heart or whatever. And,
ruptured splenic mass.
Something, right. Something going on. And they said, you're still our favorite veterinarian. And I mean, I did nothing for them. And to me, that made me feel like, hey, they trust me, even though something real bad happened.
Well, you know what you did first? You said, just get it in here, please. You know, your office didn't say, you know, he's kind of busy, maybe on Thursday. You know what I mean? You got him in, you were there, you made yourself available. You know, and they got to understand you're obviously a very busy practice. And, you know, all you got to do is make yourself available for these clients and communicate. And that will build the trust. And if you build the trust
and care,
it will save your ass in the long run.
Yeah. And care, right? Care about them or make them think you care at least.
Right.
You know, and I will say, you know, the people that do come in, reps or whoever comes into our practice, other vets, they'll say, wow, your team is great. The culture is great. And that is what I set out to do, is to change the culture. I don't care what position you are. I think you can make good money working for me if you show your value.
Yeah.
I mean, I probably have one of the highest paid technicians in the country.
Well, you know what? They're worth their value in gold. I mean, the greatest thing I did for my staff is I put them on a bonus plan, right? Where they basically, you know, I compared September of this year to September of last year, and whatever plus we were up, I divided 10% of that plus amongst all of my employees. I mean, they would get bonus checks, and you know, for $1,000-$1,500, and the profit sharing idea is huge, you know, and especially for them, because people have to understand these receptionists, these assistants, these kennel people, they could probably get more money working for Starbucks, McDonald's, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they love the culture, they love the practice, they love the clients, and if you're a decent human and a great veterinarian and you treat them well, they will go to the end of the world and back for you.
Absolutely.
And that's, I mean, I hope that's our biggest take home message. That and get everything in writing, right, Anders?
Yeah.
So, but dude, I want to thank you. Yeah. I want you to get home to your family. Go check on that gastrotomy.
Yeah.
It was so, I want you on again because I really love your personal story as far as like, you're like, I knew going in that I was going to have to work my butt off, mark my tail off, put all these hours in the front so I could start enjoying it sooner than later.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand the work-life balance and all that. And as I've been telling, you know, my guests, I'm like, if you look at your professional identity, that's what do your values actually match up to the values of what it takes to be successful and happy in the profession? And if work-life balance is your number one value, I don't think the veterinary medicine's for you.
Right. Absolutely.
Let me take that back. Clinical veterinary medicine is not for you.
Yeah, you could be a radiologist.
Radiologist, you can work for a lab company. You can work for a pharmaceutical company. You can go back and teach. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do as a veterinarian. You do not need to be a clinician. But there are certain values that are very important that to you, because they're your own personal values, but there are certain values as well that the profession holds that are important to become successful and happy in what you do.
Yeah.
And work-life balance, unfortunately, is probably number four.
Right. And you can achieve it. It's just when you have a whole bunch of stuff that you have to take care of up front, take care of that first. Correct. May have to work harder at the beginning, and you should probably, because you're going to be a better veterinarian if you are. Now, I'll tell you what, I was real worried about closing on Saturdays. We closed. But, you know, two young kids, it's like, you know, I want to be home for them. I work long hours. So I already had my half day Thursday, you know, where I get off at 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And so I closed. Revenue went up.
Because your appointments didn't spread out. They knew you were closed on Saturdays, and then all of a sudden they started to book your Monday through Fridays.
Yeah. So revenue went up, and you know, I get to see my kids Saturday morning. We have a dog named Waffles. So Saturdays are Waffles with Waffles. And they, you know.
They love it.
They love it.
They love it.
Yeah, two and
you'll never
and
get
six,
it back.
Right? And it's totally worth it.
Well, yeah, you know, my daughters now are, you know, I got one out of college, one almost done with college, and another one going to college. And I mean, that's the whole thing. You know, this whole conversation started with you met us 14 years ago.
Yeah.
That's insane to me. So
18.
18. 18. Holy Jesus. Yeah, that's crazy. So anyways, Anders, it was great talking to you. I'm going to have you back on 1,000% because I really love talking to you. I think your story and your vision of the practice is basically you're living, you truly as a, I want to say young, but as an earlier career professional are actually having the same route that I did, which made you fall in love with the profession as much as it is. And it's more of a passion now.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
It's not a job.
No.
It is not a job.
No, not at all.
So, all right. All right, everybody. Anders, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
And we'll see you next time.